Prabhupada Rajagacharya Asatara Satishusha Matas Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Maharaj Prabhupada Ki Jai. ISKCON Founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Nantakoti Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Jai. Now, Prem Shri Gaur Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shri Vasadi Gaur Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai. Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gaur Gopinath Shyamakunda Radhakunda Giri Govardhana Ki Jai. Vrindavan Dhamma Ki Jai. Mathura Dhamma Ki Jai. Navajit Mayapur Dhamma Ki Jai. Jagannath Puri Dhamma Ki Jai. Gangamaya Jamuna Devi Ki Jai. Bhakti Devi Ki Jai. Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai. Samaveta Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai. Gaur Pranayanda. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane. Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauravani Pacharane Nirvisesa Srinivadi Paskachade Satarane. Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Guru Vaishnavam Shri Shri Rupam Sarvajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Sam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitam Shri Panchakalpa Chubhishcha Kipasnavirvacha Pitanam Pavaneva Vaishnavirvamonaha. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
September 18, 2017, Skype class from Hilo, Hawaii, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 26, Text 2. Jnanam Nishreya Sartaya.
Jnanam Nishreya Sartaya.
Purushasyatma Darshana.
Purushasyatma Darshana.
Yadahur Varna Etate.
Yadahur Varna Etate.
Vidaya Granti Vedanam. Gyanam.
Gyanam.
Knowledge.
Knowledge.
Nishrayasya Artaya.
Nishrayasya Artaya.
For the ultimate perfection.
For the ultimate perfection.
Purushasya. Of a man.
Of a man.
Atmadarshanam.
Atmadarshanam.
Self-realization.
Self-realization.
Yet.
Yet.
Which.
Which.
Ahu.
Ahu.
They said.
They said.
Varnaye.
Varnaye.
I shall explain.
I shall explain.
Covering up the tut.
Tut.
That.
That.
Tay.
Tay.
To you.
To you.
Hridaya.
Hridaya.
In the heart.
In the heart.
Granti.
Granti.
The knots.
The knots.
Bhedanam.
Bhedanam.
Cuts. Just again. Translation again. Knowledge is the ultimate perfection of self-realization. I shall explain that knowledge unto you by which the knots of attachment to the material world are cut. Srila Prabhupada's purport. It is said that by proper understanding of the pure self or by self-realization, one can be free from material attachment. Knowledge leads one to attain the ultimate perfection of life and to see oneself as he is. The Svetasvara Upanishad 3.8 also confirms this. Tam eva vidivate nityam eti. Simply by understanding one's spiritual position or by seeing oneself as he is, one can be freed from material entanglement. In various ways, the seeing of oneself is described in the Vedic literatures, and it is confirmed in the Bhagavatam, Purushasya Atmadarshanam. That's this, today's verse Prabhupada's quoting here. That one has to see oneself and know what he is. As Kapila Dev explains to his mother, this quote, seeing, unquote, can be done by hearing from the proper authoritative source. Kapila Dev is the greatest authority because he is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And if someone accepts whatever is explained as it is, without interpretation, then he can see himself. Lord Chaitanya explained to Sanatana Goswami the real constitutional position of the individual. He said directly that each and every individual soul is eternally a servitor of Krishna, Jivara Swarupaya Krishna Nityadasa, CC Madhya 2108. Every individual soul is eternally a servitor, and when one is fixed in the understanding that he is part and parcel of the Supreme Soul, and that his eternal position is to serve in association with the Supreme Lord, he becomes self-realized. This position of rightly understanding oneself cuts the knot of material attraction, Ridaya Granti Bairanam, again Prabhupada's quoting from this verse, due to false ego or false identification of oneself with the body and the material world. One is entrapped by Maya, but as soon as one understands that he is qualitatively the same substance as the Supreme Lord, because he belongs to the same category of spirit soul, and that his perpetual position is to serve, one attains Atmadarshanam and Hridaya Granti Bedanam, self-realization. When one can cut the knot of attachment to the material world, his understanding is called knowledge. Atmadarshanam means to see oneself by knowledge. Therefore, one is free from the false ego by the cultivation of real knowledge. He sees himself, and that is the ultimate necessity of human life. The soul is thus isolated from the entanglement of the 24 categories of material nature. Pursuit of the systematic philosophic process called Sankhya is called knowledge and self-revelation. Jnanam nishreyasartaya purushasyatvadarshanam yad ahur varnaye tatte hridaya granti bhedanam. Knowledge is the ultimate perfection of self-realization. I shall explain that knowledge unto you by which the knots of attachment to the material world are cut. So we have this Hridaya Granti Bhedanam, to cutting a knot in the heart. Now, on the gross level, sometimes people get blockages in their heart. Sometimes the blood going to and from the heart gets clotted, or the arteries, veins going through to and from the heart, they get filled up with plaque, with some kind of fatty substance, and the blood can't flow properly, and the person is in danger of a heart attack. And so the expert surgeon, they cut these knots in the heart. They may cut out the affected blood vessel, and then they do a workaround. They put in something that goes around the blood vessel, or they may put in a balloon into the blood vessel and blow it up to try to unblock the blood vessel. So this verse is not talking about this sort of surgical procedure on the gross heart. Hridaya here does not refer to the muscle in the chest that is beating. So it's not saying here if you know yourself, you won't have a heart attack and you won't get clogged arteries. But Hridaya also means the consciousness. According to the Vedic scriptures, the consciousness is very much associated with the heart rather than with the brain. And the consciousness is heart. We associate very much, of course, all over the world with emotions. In fact, people sometimes die from what's called broken heart syndrome, that someone they love has died or someone they love has abandoned them, and they're so emotionally upset that they have a heart attack and die. So there is a connection between the emotions and the consciousness and the physical heart. But here it's talking about a different kind of knot in the heart, although it has a similar effect, that things don't flow. There's not health. There is suffering. So if there's an accumulation of plaque or a blood clot in the main arteries of the heart, one will get very sick and one can die. And these other knots in the heart, these are subtle knots, these also can cause us to be very sick. In fact, all of our suffering is caused by these material knots in the heart and the subtle level. And these are our attachments to this world, our identification with this world. And if we want to get free of identification with this world, then we identify with the spiritual world. It's actually a very simple concept. It's not a difficult thing to understand. If you change your identity, then you don't suffer because of the old identity. You know, just like if somebody is really suffering in their marriage, they change their identity and they get divorced, they become a single person again. That's the idea, then they change, they eliminate the suffering from that identity. Of course, it doesn't always work so well. But that's the concept. You know, if I'm in some country that's, you know, I'm in Syria and I'm identifying as a Syrian and so I'm in the war, well, then I go someplace else. I go to Germany, I become a German citizen, I change my identity. And in this way, I get rid of that suffering. You know, if I don't like living at home with my parents when I'm growing up, so I get a job and I get my own place to live and I change my identity. So in this way, you know, I don't like my job or whatever, you know, I get another job, I change my identity. So we do this all the time, that we escape. We understand that our suffering is due to basically how we identify ourselves, how I understand who I am. And that by changing our identity, we can eliminate that suffering. As I said, it's not a very difficult thing to understand. All of our suffering comes from attachment to something that is not. All attachment comes from ignorance of identity. Having knowledge from the Lord reveals our real identity, and when we see our real identity, our attachment to the false identity is cut, and therefore we are free from suffering and we come to real life. So that's basically the point of this purport. By proper understanding, we read in the first line, by proper understanding of the pure self, one can be free from material attachment. Of course, interestingly enough, if we go on to the end of the purport, Srila Prabhupada seems to be saying it goes the opposite. He says that when one is free from the false ego by the cultivation of real knowledge, he sees himself, and that is the ultimate necessity. So it sounds like the knowledge frees you from the false identity, which then automatically reveals your real identity. And in the first part of the purport, Prabhupada seems to be saying knowledge reveals your real identity, which cuts your connection with the false identity. And we'll examine which direction does this go, or does it go in both directions. But let's just go through the basic points here. That suffering comes from attachment. You know, if somebody that I don't know loses all their money, I don't suffer because I have no attachment to that person. I mean, right now, at this particular moment, which is 6:16 a.m. in Hawaii, on September 18th. So at this particular moment, in this particular second of time, some babies right now in the world are being born, and somebody is rejoicing at the birth. And some of those babies have been born dead, and some of them have been born with some terrible disease, and so people are lamenting. I'm not emotionally affected by either of those because I don't have any attachment to those people. Right? I mean, somebody right now is in the middle of a war, is being killed in a war. Someone is dying from a terrible disease. And one of the side effects of being part of a social media network, so I'm on Facebook, if I scroll through my newsfeed, if I take, say, 10, 15 minutes and just scroll through my newsfeed, some baby has been born, some relative has died, somebody has been accepted into a school, somebody has graduated from a school, somebody has lost a job, somebody has gotten a job, somebody has gotten engaged, somebody has gotten married, somebody has gotten divorced, and so forth and so on. And if I know these people, then I'm affected. And the greater my association with them, the greater my emotional effect. And if I don't really know them, my emotional effect is very small. You know, expert journalists will try to get you to have some attachment to the people that they're writing about. If they just say, you know, 25,000 people died in an earthquake, you're like, wow, that's terrible. You know, where's my juice? Where's my sandwich? You know, you just go on with your life. It doesn't affect you. So the closer that something is to your own identity, the more suffering there is. And of course, when it's in one's own body, when, you know, you're the one who broke your arm, or you're the one who has a high fever, or you're the one who's lost all your money, then you're very affected. Or somebody very close to you. Sometimes we're more affected by difficulty to a child or to a parent than we are even to ourselves. Anyway, we can understand that all suffering is due to attachment. And as we can also understand that all suffering is due to identity. This attachment comes from identity. Why aren't I upset about some terribly deformed child that's being born right now in the world in Burma, you know, Manimal, it was called that. Because I'm not identifying with that. I think I'm an American. I'm not from Manimal. I don't know anybody there. I don't have any relatives there. I don't have any ancestors from there. So I don't identify with it. It doesn't mean anything to me. Right? That's the basis of my attachment. My basis of the attachment is, you know, I and mine. That's the basis of my attachment. If it has something to do with me, then I'm affected. It's a question of identity. Why am I affected by this body? Because I'm identified. I think this is me. I think this is my means of achieving my desires. Right? When Didichi was asked for his bones by the demigods, he's like, you know, who's going to give up their body? Lord Vishnu, in speaking to Vrikasura, he says to him, you know, you've been running all over the universe looking for Lord Shiva, but, you know, you're kind of wearing out your body. How are you going to get your desires fulfilled without your body? So I'm thinking like that. You know, if my body can't walk and talk and see and hear and function, and how am I going to be happy? It's me. This is the source of my happiness, and the same with my mind. So, you know, it's all identity. It's all identity. If you stop identifying with it, it doesn't affect you anymore. I mean, those of us who joined the Hare Krishna movement as adults, so many of us just like walked away from our previous families and societies. And, you know, to the point that if you hear about something, this happened in your family, whatever, it may have basically no effect of suffering anymore. So how do we get free of suffering is we come to our real identity. Now let's look a little bit at to why our real identity would free us from suffering. It's a very simple point that's evidence for the existence of God and the existence of the soul. It's one of the very obvious and logical points of evidence. And that is that nobody wants to suffer. Everybody wants to be happy. Everybody. The scientists call this the pleasure principle. And it's true even for the minuscule living entities. You know, even for a teeny tiny insect. A teeny tiny insect will run away from potential suffering and run towards pleasure. And the kind of pleasure that we want is we want eternal pleasure. We want pleasure that doesn't stop. We want pleasure that goes on eternally. Nobody wants the pleasure to end. And not only do we want the pleasure to go on, we want it to keep being pleasurable. And we want it to increase. And we want it to be all-encompassing. So we all want pleasure that's completely all-encompassing for all of our senses and our mind, and that goes on without stopping and keeps getting better. And everybody wants this. You know, everybody. It's a universal desire. But if we look at the happiness that comes from our false identity, we will see it doesn't meet any of those criteria. That none of them. As soon as I identify with my body, my mind, my family, my society, my country, my occupation, my marital status, etc., 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 my religion, the happiness I get in relationship to those identities is temporary, often very temporary. It's limited in scope. You know, you climbed a mountain, you see a beautiful view, but you're not experiencing taste. You know, you have to also eat. So it's limited in scope, and it's also limited in time. It has a beginning and an end. And it's limited in time in the sense that it gets boring. So the people who walk up to the top of the mountain, they experience some thrill, but the people who live there, it just becomes ordinary. You know, so I'm here in Hawaii, people come here for a vacation, they work really hard for a long time to come here, but I live here, you know, that I've got passion fruit growing in the backyard, and tangerines growing in the front yard, and macadamia nuts growing in the backyard, and gardenias, and lang lang, and to me it's fairly ordinary. It doesn't give me the same amount of thrill as if I was visiting. So why would we want something universally, everybody wants something that is simply impossible according to our present identity. So that's very strong evidence for the fact that we are not that identity. It's just like a fish. You know, we had the misfortune the other day down by the ocean to see somebody fishing. You know, when you take the fish out of water, the fish wants to be in the water. The fish can't breathe air in the air. The fish can only breathe in the water. And why, when you take a fish out of water, does it want water? Because that's its natural habitat. It's indicative. A fish out of water that's struggling to breathe. We're like, I can breathe in the air. What's the problem? Why can't you breathe in the air? Its desire is indicative that it has a different habitat. You know, when I go underwater, my need for being in the air is indicative that my natural habitat is different. So the fact that I have a desire that cannot be fulfilled according to this identity is very clear and strong evidence that my natural identity is something different. Now, all this can be understood just by being a little thoughtful. Everything we've said so far can be understood without reference to any kind of authority. Although, you know, people in materialistic society often don't understand these things because they're bombarded with opposite messages from their schools, from their parents, from their religious leaders even, and certainly nowadays from the media, they're bombarded with the message that you are this body, you are a black person, you are a Korean person, you know, you are a man, you are whatever, you are these things, and you will find happiness by buying this new laundry detergent. So, you know, people are bombarded with that, and so their natural ability to understand these things we just mentioned may be hampered. But anybody who's reasonably thoughtful can understand all my suffering is due to attachment, all my attachment is due to my identity, and I have a natural desire for happiness that is impossible to be fulfilled in this identity. Therefore, I must have a different kind of identity. You don't need scripture, you don't need guru, you don't need anything to understand that. Although, again, most people, I would hazard to say that most people at the present time probably do not understand this. But if you're going to go beyond that, what is my real identity? Oh, my real identity must be in a constant state of never-ending, ever-expanding happiness. Okay, but what is it? What is it exactly? So what people try to do is they try to cut off, if they're doing this particular verse is talking, as Prabhupada mentions, about Sankhya or Gyan. And of course it's talking about Gyan Yoga, not just about ordinary Gyan. But on the platform of Gyan Yoga, often the idea is to discuss philosophically the negative, 18, 18, 18. I am not this, I am not this, I am not this. And when you eliminate all of what you are not, then what you are will shine through. And so the Gyan Yogis will often engage not only in philosophical discussion, but also in a lot of austerity and detachment. Gyan Yoga, as opposed to Karma Yoga, does not generally have one working in the world. Although Bhanuswami told me that many of the famous Gyan Yogis in the Shastra are grihasthas. They don't seem to be grihasthas in the sense of having an ordinary career below that of a brahmana. You don't find very many Gyan Yogis as Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, and Shudras. They're living in some sort of a renounced platform as a brahmana grahastha or as a renunciate. Because their idea is not just to philosophically, I mean, that doesn't work. If you're just philosophically saying, I'm not this identity, but you're acting according to that identity, it's not going to work. You're not going to be able to realize it. You know, the actions speak louder than words. Your behavior will fight against your philosophy. So the Gyan Yogi is usually going for the negative, stopping most ordinary actions in the world, being separate from the world, and just, I'm not, I'm not, I'm not, I'm not, I'm not. And eventually by doing that, one has a direct realization. We have this word here, darshana, atma darshanam. Interesting enough, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur takes this to mean seeing God. because Purushasya Atma Darshanam, Purushasya can mean the Lord. So Purushasya Atma can mean the Lord who's the ultimate self. So he takes it that one gets darshan of God. Prabhupada is more just saying this one gets darshan of the self. And of course that also generally happens simultaneously. Srila Prabhupada often says that the way we see ourselves is to see God. And when we see God, we also see ourselves. And when we see ourselves, we have to see ourselves in relationship to God. That we can't, it really, if you're going to have self-realization, you must also have God-realization. It's really impossible to have one without the other. I mean, how could I realize I'm an American citizen without knowing something about America? You know, it really goes very much together. So anyway, the idea with Gyan Yoga is if you eliminate the false, you will reveal the real. And that makes sense, right? So you have, a diamond, and it's gotten really dirty. It's fallen in the mud or the sewer or something. And by washing it, you'll reveal the diamond. You don't have to work at revealing the diamond. You just have to work at getting rid of the stuff. So that's the basic view of Gyan Yoga, that you're getting rid of the gunk. Of course, there's a problem with just Gyan Yoga in doing that, and that if you're just getting rid of the gunk without focusing on your real self, it's not very satisfying. Klesha dikatrash chesham. In fact, Arjuna asked this question, which prompted Krishna's response in 12.5 of the Bhagavad Gita. He says, should I just try to realize Atma? Which the Acharyas talk about, as either God or the self, or both. In other words, should I first realize myself, and then I engage in bhakti? This morning's lecture I was hearing by Prabhupada, in fact, he made the point, Brahma Bhuta Prasanatmana Sochitina Kanchiji Sama Sarveshu Bhuteshu Mad Bhakti Mabhate Param, that one doesn't engage in real bhakti until one has realized the self. He says the bhakti done before that is prakriti. It's materialistic. One is a prakriti bhakta. One's a materialistic devotee. So you could say, well, if I don't engage in bhakti until I've realized the self, then let me first realize the self through gyan, and then after I've realized the self through gyan, then I'll engage in bhakti. And by this gyan, we mean the negative, generally. So Krishna's saying, well, don't do that. That's going to be troublesome. I mean, one can also realize the self first through karma yoga or through gyan yoga. Right? And in fact, when Arjuna asked this question in the 12th chapter, Krishna's already explained both karma yoga. He's explained karma yoga, gyan yoga, and gyan yoga. He's explained all of those in addition to bhakti. The 12th verse is, Acharyas tell us, is the last, 12th chapter rather, is of the Bhagavad Gita, is the last chapter in the middle bhakti section. But he's explained everything. Of course, Krishna goes into gyan yoga a lot more in chapters 13 through 17. But he's also discussed gyan yoga, especially in chapter 4. So Arjuna is saying, should I do these other yogas first and then do bhakti? So which way is it going here? Is it going that we see our real identity and then we lose the attachments, or we lose the attachments and then we see our real identity? Well, here Luka Piladev, although he's speaking about Sankhya, he's speaking about gyan, his primary instruction is bhakti. So this is not a gyan that's covering bhakti. Gyanakarma anavrata. We're not talking about, Lord Kapila Dev is not suggesting that Devahuti engage in gyan yoga. He wants her to engage in bhakti yoga. That's very clear from the whole context of this section. And in fact, that fact, that this verse has to be understood in context, is very important in terms of the last sentence of the first paragraph of the purport. Srila Prabhupada says in the second clause of that sentence, if someone accepts whatever is explained as it is without interpretation, then he can see himself. So this as it is without interpretation is quite important to understand. Srila Prabhupada used the English word interpretation in a very specific way that is not completely the dictionary definition of the word interpretation in English in 2017. So in 2017, in an American English dictionary, the word interpretation and the word explanation have almost exactly the same meaning. Now, an interpretation could mean a metaphorical, symbolic, allegorical interpretation. It could mean some sort of extrapolation. It could mean you're going beyond explaining the meaning. But it doesn't have to. But Srila Prabhupada consistently uses the word interpretation like that. I mean, as a teacher, when we have Bloom's taxonomy of questions which indicate deeper and deeper levels of knowledge, as this verse is about knowledge. So the first level is called just knowledge or information in English, and by that we mean being able to simply repeat facts. That's all, you know, you say 225 million animals are being slaughtered every second on the planet, and you repeat that fact, and you know it. You have knowledge of information. The next step is called understanding or interpretation. We use the word interpretation, and by that we mean that you can translate that fact into your own words. So instead of just repeating 225 million animals are slaughtered every second on the planet, you could repeat it in your own words, and you could say, you know, at every moment there's a quarter of a billion animals that are being killed for their meat, for their skin, or for other products for human consumption. So you're explaining that. You're showing by putting that, the original statement in your own words, that you understand the meaning. If you just parrot it back, you may not understand the meaning. But if you explain it a little differently, then you show you understand the meaning. And on that stage of teaching, we can also ask people to transform the original statement into another form completely. Like we could say, draw a picture of it. Or we could say, make it into a poem. Make it into a dance. Write a little musical piece about it. So if you change it from one thing to another, or you change something from one language to another, for example, that shows that understanding, and we use the word interpretation for that. So in English, again, the word interpretation simply means to show that you understood something as it is. That's what we mean. You know, well, what's your interpretation of it? What's your understanding of it? What's your explanation of it? Those are all synonyms in English that show that you got the as-it-is meaning. In fact, in empathic listening, that's the main technique, is someone says something, and then you reflect back to them what you understand they meant, and then they confirmed, yes, that's what I meant. It's a technique to encourage understanding. Srila Prabhupada is not using the word interpretation in this way. Srila Prabhupada uses the interpretation as, instead of you express that you've understood the actual meaning, by interpretation, he means that you change the meaning in some way. And when Prabhupada wants to talk about showing understanding, he uses the word explain. So this is a very important point to understand. So if we're going to explain what something means, if we're going to get to the as-it-is meaning, then we have to look at the statement in context. Doing that is part of what's called hermeneutics. Hermeneutics is, how does one understand the meaning of Shastra? Again, hermeneutics, an English definition, you're going to go, how do you interpret Shastra? Probably saying, don't interpret. So you might say, well, we don't do hermeneutics. Well, we certainly do. It's what I'm doing right now. I'm explaining this verse in purport. That's what Prabhupada's doing in his purport. He's explaining the verse. And you'll notice that Srila Prabhupada explains the verse in terms of bhakti. You know, in the second paragraph, it's a short purport, it's two paragraphs. In the second paragraph, he explains this verse in terms of bhakti. He immediately puts it in the context of bhakti. Well, if Prabhupada is explaining this verse as it is, if he's not doing what he calls interpretation, if he's not using this verse to bring out a meaning contrary or different from what was intended. So why is he talking about bhakti in the purport when the verse itself has no mention whatsoever of bhakti? If you just simply look at the verse, it's talking about gyan. The word is gyan. And that is because he's looking at the verse in context. Now, there are some scholars who say, well, Srila Prabhupada's not giving an accurate translation, an accurate commentary, because he's trying to skew bhakti out of everything. He's looking at a verse about Gyan Yoga, and he's interpreting it as Bhakti Yoga. He's changing the meaning and coming up with his own meaning of Bhakti Yoga. But that if you understand that hermeneutics means that you have to look at the verse in context, then the context is the entire conversation that Kapila Dev is having with Devahuti. That's your immediate context. And we see that Kapila Dev is certainly teaching Sankhya, no doubt about it. And he's emphasizing bhakti. So his teaching of Sankhya is as a part of bhakti. It's not covering bhakti, it's not competing with bhakti, it's part of bhakti. Therefore, when we see this word atmadarshanam, that one can see oneself through jnana, through knowledge, we're understanding these words jnana and atmadarshana not to refer to simply jnana yoga, where you just detach from the world and you engage in philosophical talk. And this understanding of what Lord Kapila Dev is communicating with these words, which we understand by the context of his whole conversation, and we could even take it to a greater circle, we understand it in the context of the Bhagavatam as a whole. We look at that this conversation, this verse, is taking place within the context of the Bhagavatam, and the Bhagavatam as a whole is putting everything in relationship to bhakti. We can also look at this verse in the context of the ultimate Siddhanta, which is explained in the Chatur Slok of the Bhagavatam, the original seed of the Bhagavatam. And that way, our conclusion, our explanation of the meaning of this verse, the meaning of jnana and atmadarshana, and which way it goes, how does the circle go, will be in line with what Lord Kapila Dev intends to communicate. So do you first study knowledge about how you're not this body and not this identity, and in that way you get revealed that you're the soul, or you gain knowledge of how you're a soul, and that knowledge automatically cuts your attachment? You know, going in the positive direction, we can see, I didn't read it, I just read about it, that there was a certain country in the year, but there was some place at some time that people were buying or stealing children from poor families and selling them to wealthy families. In most cases, they were stealing them. Sometimes they were stealing newborn infants. Sometimes they were stealing very young children. And these children were not told that they had been taken from their families. And they were not told that they were adopted. And later on, when they found out, some of these children were able to find out their real identity, they automatically became detached from their false identity. This idea of finding your real identity is a very common theme in fiction. That somebody is especially somebody who's raised in poverty and obscurity and finds out that they're actually a prince or something like that. It's a very, very common theme. And of course, to some extent, you could say, in a Rasika sense, that's happening in Krishna Lila. That Krishna and Balaram are being raised in Vrindavan in a cowherding village without knowing that they're the children of Vasudeva and Devaki. Even Vasudeva says this to Nanda when Nanda goes to Mathura. He says that Balaram thinks that you're his real father. So this concept of a revelation of one's real identity, and we see in the Leela that Krishna and Balaram, once it's revealed by Akura that they're actually Kshatriya princes and they're the sons of Vasudeva and Devaki, they leave Vrindavan. And for the rest of their manifest Leela, they act as Kshatriyas in Mathura and Dwarka. Of course, in Krishna Leela, we see this a little differently. We see that Krishna's ultimate identity is actually in Vraja, not in Mathura and Dwarka. His ultimate expression of identity is as a cowherd. And so this is a different understanding than the normal trajectory of the revelation of identity. But anyway, it's interesting that this happens even in Krishna's pastimes, that he has some pastime like this of a revelation of identity, which from a mundane perspective, if you're the prince of a grand city, then that's a much more wonderful thing than you're just a cowherd in a village. In fact, the demons criticize Krishna like this. You know, even at the marriage of Krishna's grandson with Rukmini's granddaughter, So Rukmi and the king of Kalinda, they're criticizing Balara. Of course you don't know how to play chess, you know, you're just a village boy. So this concept that as soon as your real identity is revealed, then you become detached from your false identity. Even if your real identity, in the case of these children that were stolen, if your real identity is revealed that you're poor, you know, you may become disgusted from your rich identity. I mean, one interesting true story I read a while ago, fascinating story. It was in South America somewhere, I can't remember exactly where. And these two women gave birth in a hospital at the same time. They each gave birth to sets of identical twins. And one of the boys from each set was switched with the other. So each woman went home with what she thought was fraternal twins. And one was a very rich family in the city, one was a very poor family in the country. And it wasn't until the four boys were adults that they started having some mutual friends. And the mutual friends would say, hey, you know, you look exactly like this person. And they were able to find out their real identity. And at which point, you know, of course they still had some attachment to the family that raised them. But by finding out their real identity, they become detached from the false identity. So what happens first? That you become detached from the false identity, and in this way you reveal the real identity, like you're washing the mud off of a jewel without knowing that there's a jewel underneath. You just pick up something and you're washing it off and you think, oh, look at this. Or that you're attached to the real identity, and because of that you naturally lose attraction to the false identity. Which way does it go? Well, in one sense it goes both ways. Prabhupada mentions both ways in this purport. And in the process of bhakti, our primary way, as opposed to the process of gyan, is focusing on our real identity, as Prabhupada says here. Jivarasvara Paya Krishnara Nityadash. We're doing that from day one. As soon as somebody has contact with bhakti yoga, as taught by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, coming in the line from Rupa Goswami, Sanatana Jiva Goswami, as being taught by the followers of Bhakti Siddhanta, Srila Prabhupada, the first thing that happens is we engage in activities of our real identity immediately. I mean, the first time I visited a Hare Krishna temple, they're having me water Tulsi Devi. That's activities of service. Right? They're engaging me in kirtan. And the first night I stayed in a Hare Krishna temple, they had me make a garland for the Jagannath deities. It was a terrible garland. Oh my God, it was just awful. But anyway, that's what they had me do. They had me do some service. They had me act as a servant of Krishna. And you become attached to that because it is the real identity. You know, because it is who we really are, we experience some happiness from that. And that can happen at the very beginning. You experience some happiness from doing service. And that happiness, you're like, wow, what was that? It's happiness on the spiritual platform, even for a beginner. Unlike the gyanis who were, you know, it's so dry. Klesha. It's dry. I'm not this body. I'm not this country. I'm not this. It's all suffering. The world. That's so dry. But, you know, you eat one sweet ball. I was just hearing Prabhupada say this. You know, you taste the sweet ball. You say, oh, this is simply wonderful. I mean, the first time I had a sandesh, I couldn't believe it. What is this? It was just, I couldn't stop thinking about it. What is this experience? You know, I was at a temple in Slovakia once where there was a guest came for the second time and he said, this chanting is better than sex. What is it? You know, we have some amazing experience. Pratyakshavagamam dharmam. You experience directly. Wait a minute. This is a different kind of happiness. And from that direct experience related to our real identity, we become detached. Like Ravindrasri Prabhu says, you know, he's chanting Hare Krishna, and he just started losing the desire to smoke. He said then he stopped chanting because he thought, what kind of mantra am I chanting? Or I know one devotee who's also a Catholic monk. In fact, he's a major world preacher of Catholicism still, but he's practicing Krishna consciousness. And he was talking to me. He said, when I started chanting Hare Krishna, he said, I just became so detached naturally from the material world. He said, I'd never engaged in such a powerful spiritual process. So certainly, as part of bhakti yoga, we also discuss philosophy. We also work at being detached. You know, if one wants one's activities of bhakti to go more quickly, then we have no eating of meat, fish, or eggs, no intoxication, no illicit sex, and no gambling. Those are all detachment things from the false identity of this body and this world. And, you know, they're all going to be hindrances. Our main process, however, is attachment to our real identity. And that we're getting by actively engaging in service. Practically engaging, practical service. And Prabhupada makes this point over and over again, especially in the verse in Nectar Instruction. He's talking about utsaha, what is enthusiasm. He said, we're bhakti yogis, it's not, I mean, smaranam is a practice of bhakti, meditation is a practice of bhakti. But our main process is to be active, to do some active service. And we experience, wow. You know, I'm happy. It's interesting. In psychology, there's been studies that show that if you want to get someone to like you, don't do things for them. Get them to do things for you. We usually think, if I want someone to like me, I'll do things for them. And if I do things for them, they'll see that I like them, and they'll feel some gratitude. They'll appreciate me. Wow, what a nice person. They're doing things for me. That doesn't generally work. I wonder if the reason it doesn't generally work is because of pride, because we figure if people are doing things for us, it's not because they're so nice, but because we're so nice, and these normally foolish people have finally figured out how wonderful I am, and therefore they're doing things for me. So we don't really see that as a great credit on their part. But the interesting thing is, if you get people to do things for you, the way we think, according to the psychologists, anyway, is that if I'm doing something for someone, I will think, why am I doing this for someone? I must like them. And so if you can get people to do you favors and do service for you, they'll actually like you. Sorry. So it works like that. If you can get someone to do service for Krishna, their natural, not as some manipulative psychological trick, but their natural attachment for Krishna will awaken. And interestingly enough, the primary service we do, of course, is Shravanam Kirtanam. So the primary service we do that awakens this attachment and awakens our real identity is not a hands and legs kind of service. It's hearing. And Lord Kapila Dev is stressing this hearing of knowledge. So what do we want to hear? We want to hear about how the material world is suffering and I'm not this body. And yeah, that's there. But we also want to hear about how wonderful Krishna is, and we want to hear about the nature of the soul. We want to hear about our real identity. We want to hear about our real place. And that attracts us, as Prabhupada talks about in the descriptions of the kingdom of God in the Bhagavatam. One should become captivated by this information. We should become captivated by the descriptions of the spiritual world, the descriptions of the Lord, the descriptions of ourself. And this hearing has to be submissive. It has to be submissive hearing. We certainly should ask questions and we should discuss, but not just challenge. I mean, I've been having a back and forth conversation with one woman from Australia, a chat, and she calls herself an absolutist vegan. I would say almost militaristic. So she's just saying, you know, I really like to chant Hare Krishna, I'm interested in Krishna consciousness, but, you know, can I be a devotee without having anything to do with dairy products? And I said, well, you know, in temples we offer dairy products to the Lord. She said, well, can I visit a temple at a time when they're not making an offering of dairy? You know, she just doesn't want any connection with dairy. And she was saying to me, you know, if you're keeping an animal, it must be exploitive. There's no way you can keep an animal without it being exploited. It's impossible. Actually, I'll just read to you what she said, because I thought it was very interesting if we want to talk about how we should hear in order to realize ourself. So, let's see, she says, the cows are being bred and raised only to obtain commodities to be used exclusively as resources. So that's her, that's the way she sees the world. She sees that if you have cows, the only reason that you are going to have cows is that you want their commodity, you want their resources. And I agreed with her that that would be an exploitive relationship. I said, you know, it's like if you marry someone just to get their money or just for sex, or then it's an exploitive relationship. Any time that you deal with another living being for the sole purpose of getting some commodity from them, then it's an exploitive relationship. And I said, you know, and we were going back and forth with this, and she just kept repeating her point. So in that kind of mood, you're not actually going to understand anything. You know, I had to say over and over again, you're making a false assumption. You might breed animals for another reason. You might keep animals for another reason. The commodities might be a side effect and not your primary reason. And she just kept saying, no, if you're breeding animals, keeping animals, you must be wanting to exploit them. And finally what I wrote to her is I said that, our bhakti philosophy is explained in the Gita is that no action should be done for the purpose of wanting to enjoy the fruits of that action. So whether you're raising cows, whether you're raising children, whatever you're doing, nothing should be done with the idea of enjoying the fruits. Anything you're doing with the idea of enjoying the fruits is more or less exploitive. But we're going on for days and she's not able to hear my points because she's so fixed in this idea that all animal raising has to be by nature exploitive. It's impossible to have a non-exploitive relationship with an animal. So that's my point, is that's not submissive hearing. That means, you know, when she first contacted me, I thought, oh, this is somebody who actually has some interest in Krishna consciousness and some curiosity and wants to progress. And as the conversation went on, I could understand, no, this is someone who just, you know, wants to assert their own opinion very strongly. So if we're going to understand about our real identity and we're going to understand about Krishna and become detached, we need to do so with submission. And that means we need to find a guru to whom we can submit. We need to find Shastra to whom we can submit. We need to have authorities. We can certainly discuss. We're supposed to discuss. We're supposed to ask questions. We're supposed to assure the guru we've come to an understanding. Like Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya said to Mahaprabhu, you know, you haven't asked any questions. You haven't said anything. I have no idea if you understand me or not. So that we're supposed to do. But we're not supposed to come with a challenging, argumentative mood, firmly stuck in our own opinions without the possibility of changing. If we do, then no matter how much we engage in hearing and chanting and service, we will not become purified. So I have about 4 minutes here before we have our program with the kids here. So any questions or comments? Yeah, sure.
But the tail end of the talk about the militant vegan position, there's such a dark downside to this vegan. I mean, they want to protect the animals, that's good, but it blocks them off. But couldn't you say this is the plane of exploitation? One living entity is food for another. That's, you know, that's where we live. But being a devotee, of course, you know, changes all that.
Well, I did say that, but the argument on that side will be, well, let's exploit as little as possible, and let's at least exploit non-sentient beings like plants rather than exploiting sentient beings like animals. I mean, their basic supposition is that, again, a non-exploitive relationship with an animal is impossible. And I said to her that it appeared to me that her argument was predicated on consent, because any thoughtful person will admit that our relationship between humans is also to some extent exploitive. We can't purge our relationship with sentient beings of exploitation entirely. We just can't do that. So what would be the difference between our having a somewhat exploitive relationship with a human and a somewhat exploitive relationship with an animal? And the difference would be consent, that you'd have to say the animal's not able to consent. Another difference would be the power differential, which again has to do with consent. And it's the power differential, for example, that in law has this what we call statutory rape, or the age of consent. So, you know, we, even if it's a consensual sexual relationship, if one person is a minor and the age difference is too great, then we consider it a kind of rape because of the power differential. And that's the same reason why, to some extent in law and to some extent in norms, that we don't accept sexual relationships between authorities and subordinates. You know, if you're in the military, you don't have a relationship with a subordinate officer, and you don't have a relationship with between a teacher and a student, because we say the power differential prevents actual consent from the subordinate. So if you're going to say that we're entering into a symbiotic, loving relationship with a cow or a sheep or a goat or something like that, you'd say that it's not really a symbiotic or loving relationship, because that animal is in a position of powerlessness and is not capable of giving consent. So my answer to that is that we are also enjoined as humans to have a relationship with the natural world, that many animals, in fact, do seek out humans for a relationship. Even wild animals seek out humans for a relationship. And humans seek out animals for a relationship of love and service. So it's a fact that an animal cannot consent on the level of a human being. But on that platform, we could say a child cannot consent, but we have children. We give birth to children, and those children are not able to consent to being our children. They just get born, and there they are. They're our children. And we still take care of them out of a mood of service. So even though there's a power differential, even though the animal's not able to give consent in the way that a human can, still there can be a mood of loving service. I'm doing this for Krishna. I'm taking care of Krishna's creatures to please Krishna, to please Guru, not for my own fruitive thing, not to make money from the animal, not to get a living from the animal. I'm doing it as service. And the fact that I get wool or milk or honey from the animal, plowing from the animal, is something I accept as prasad. I do the activity as a service, and I get it as prasad. I'm not doing the activity to get that result. And if you don't come to that spiritual platform, then the fact that there is a power differential and the fact that the animals have a difficulty consenting will tend to push people towards exploitation. So it is true that once you allow humans to use animals as resources, that people in general will go to a more exploitive position. But that's true in everything. That's true in marriage, that's true in raising children, that's true in all of our relationships, that people without bhakti will tend to use those relationships, they'll tend to use their greater power, and they'll tend to exploit the other. And the other point I made to her is that if you don't take care of animals and to get some resources from them in a reciprocal, loving way, how would we till the earth? How would we plow the earth? And how would we fertilize the earth? So we're highly dependent on animal labor for plowing and for fertilization. And if you had a radically militant vegan society, then you'd no longer have access to that. Without access to that, you'd pretty much have to use machines and fossil fuels, as we're doing now, for cultivating the earth. And you'd have to create artificial fertilizer. And I just finished reading a book about the first invention of artificial fertilizer. Prabhupada says artificial fertilizer is forbidden by the Shastra. And the harm that is done to the planet, to the air, to the soil, to the water, to the living beings by using artificial fertilizer is very great. So the point I made to her is that if it was really morally superior to have absolute veganism, then why would that create a situation that harmed the planet? If you're going to judge by the result. So it's only when we live in cooperation with the natural world, in a symbiotic relationship with the natural world, and a give and take with the natural world, that we actually give health to all the creatures of the world and to the planet. And simply saying we're going to have our own human activities entirely separate from the animal kingdom does not produce that result. It's not the way things are intended. All right, I have a morning program with the boys, so sorry, I need to go. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.